It's Stokely and Zach on Sports Radio 104.3 The Fan.
Well, LeBron James reached out to Kevin Durant via text, from what I'm told, about coming to Los Angeles. I don't know what Kevin Durant's response to him was. That is not the information that I got, but I will tell you what I did hear is that behind the scenes, Kevin Durant was like, why would I do that?
All in love so strange, said you never know.
We are here, and that was Stephen A. Smith. LeBron James apparently reached out to his workout buddy. KD and LeBron have worked out consistently together through the years, and apparently LeBron has reached out to Kevin Durant about joining him on the Los Angeles Lakers. Apparently, from what we understand, and we heard you heard a little bit about it in that clip from Stephen A. Smith, is that he was rebuffed. Like, why would I go join you in L.A. when I can win championships here in Golden State? That's what this move is all about. But we are also learning, Chad Brown, and Chad Brown filling in for Brandon Stokely once again today. We are learning that talks between the Lakers and Spurs are back open. And another monumental domino in the NBA is that Paul George told Oklahoma City that he will not opt in. He had a player option. He's not opting in, pointing to another sign that this migration, let's call it.
Migration of talents, yes.
To the Los Angeles Lakers could be imminent. What do you make of it all, Chad?
You know, I'm a SoCal guy. I don't have a rooting interest in 99% of contests regardless of sport. The only real team I'm a fan of, you know, of course, I'm a fan of teams I played for, but, you know, it was a little different relationship. As a kid growing up in Southern California, the only team I'm a fan of, really, of all the sports franchises is the Lakers. So I love all this. At this point, we're talking LeBron, KD, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard. Any NBA franchise would love just to get one of those guys. The fact that you could pair this up or do a triplet thing? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me?
It would be pretty absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, even if they manage to get two of the three, they have some pretty good young talent now. But I have a feeling, I have this feeling that if one goes, all three of them are going to end up there.
Wow.
It feels like a monkey see, monkey do offseason as it pertains to the Lakers. And Here's the problem for San Antonio, and this is a serious problem for that organization, and some could say that it's an NBA problem. That the players now, when you're in a situation like Kawhi and you're this along in your career, you truly, although on the surface the Spurs have him under contract for another year, you truly as a player have control over your situation. Because, and we talked a little bit about this last week, but see the most recent example that has broken in the last 24 hours. Oklahoma City makes a deal a year ago for Paul George, okay? And it was likely in an effort to sell Russell Westbrook, and we're building here, but whatever. But they took a young, really talented player in Victor Oladipo and traded him, knowing that Paul George was there for a year and that there was a realistic possibility that Paul George may move on. They thought they could pitch him, but the fact is he was only a sure thing in a Thunder uniform for a year. Now he's opting out. Now, I know people are saying that he could still re-sign a contract, at, you know, max-level deal similar to Jokic with the Thunder, but that window may be already closed, and you made a decision to send a young player away in Victor Oladipo with no promise of a future guarantee from Paul George and ultimately may walk away with absolutely nothing. And that's why San Antonio has to be very careful about how they handle their stubbornness with dealing Kawhi, because teams know that he wants to end up as a Laker. So if you're San Antonio, you may have to ultimately accept the fact that you are not going to get anywhere close to an equal return on this thing, but still have to make a deal anyway, because if you don't, you could end up like the Thunder.
That was well explained. I don't know if I got much to add to that, really. I mean, that's how good of a job you did.
Thank you.
Breaking that down. I agree with you. The listening to the previous show with Cecil and Pritch, you know, they were talking about the power structure in the NBA and the NFL. And it's clear the NBA players have the power. And you just pointed out how that power reflects itself on a team trying to build a team, trying to go forward, trying to decide on how if we're going to retain certain players. All of that, in literally the hopes of trying to get some kind of super team going. You're willing to deal young, promising players because this guy is so good, but he's also such a influencer.
Mm.
We can get another superstar based on this guy's name. Versus, give me the young guy, the Oladipo.
Yeah, Victor Oladipo.
Yes. The Oladipo move, he's not moving a needle. He's a young, promising guy, but people aren't like, I got to get with that guy so we can win a championship.
Right.
Paul George is one of those Westbrook, what they were trying to do in Oklahoma City. That's one of those moves.
Yeah. It's very interesting, and it's a conversation that actually relates directly to the Colorado Rockies. Because they're in a very similar situation with Nolan Arenado. You see the end of the line in terms of his contract. There's a real possibility that if you don't act, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more at 2 o'clock, if you don't act the way that Mike Evans is suggesting that the Rockies act, he's saying make the deal now. Because if you walk away with nothing, it's all for naught. You had this great player that other teams desire and covet and would make a deal, but if you cling to the idea that he's going to remain a Rocky beyond his contract, you may ultimately end up with nothing, which is a scary prospect for fans. So it's fascinating. And by the way, the Rockies lose again last night, four consecutive losses following four consecutive wins. They lose in walk-off fashion. Did you see any of the game, Chad?
No, I did not see the game, but I've checked out the highlights, and it just, it's frustrating. Let's put it that way.
It is. And in a night where they get good pitching, I got to ask you real quick while we're on the topic, and I heard the guys this morning talking about it. There was a couple different spots in that game, but one pivotal spot in the game, late innings, where the Giants purposefully walk a Rockies batter in order to get to Kyle Freeland, pitcher on pitcher, bases loaded, two outs, and he K's him. And there's this is not new, okay? This is the National League.
Mm-hmm.
Pitcher's bat.
Right.
Do you like, this is a fundamental question, do you like separate rules for the separate leagues?
Well, we can find out after the break.
Okay, let's do it. All right, Chad, last night, pivotal point in the game. Kyle Freeland's at the plate. Bases are loaded. Giants walk the previous batter purposefully to get to Kyle Freeland. Okay? This is National League Baseball. This is nothing new, but it reopens the discussion whether, you know, this is a good thing for baseball at all, just in general. I heard the guys debating about it this morning on Schlereth and Evans. We talked about it last year in pivotal spots. I saw DMAC tweeting about it last night. Where do you come down that in a professional sports league, there is a fundamental rule difference between the two that has ramifications on every single game essentially played? Do you like the uniqueness of it and the old school approach of it, or do you prefer uniformity across the pro league?
I prefer uniformity across the league. It's pitchers not batting just doesn't make any sense to me. They're the guys on they're on the field on defense. Therefore, they have to have a chance to bat. It's never sat well with me ever. It's one of those things like, you know, you send your enforcer in hockey to go fight his enforcer. Never mind the guy who actually did something. It's one of those sports things that people always tell you, you just don't understand. And that's typically, you don't understand baseball. You don't understand hockey. That's one of those things that when their default answer is that, I go, you must not have a very good argument where you have to constantly say, I just don't understand it. I disagree. It doesn't make any sense. It should be uniform. Pitchers need to bat.
Oh, across the league.
Across the league. No doubt about it.
So no designated hitter. No DH.
No.
Okay. You know what? I have heard a lot of there should be a DH across the board because no one wants to see the pitcher hit. That's like one of these, you know, like.
I know we don't want to see it, but it's still part of the game. When you grow up playing baseball, you know, DH, pitchers hit. That's the origins of the game.
The NFL has tinkered. And I guess I should use tinkered in air quotes because they've shifted the rules of the game from a fundamental standpoint.
But uniformly.
Uniformly, yes. But they said, hey, this chip shot, extra point, we're going to back it up. We're going to make it more challenging. There's no more guaranteed extra point to turn a 6 to a 7. So they have been proactive in changing their game.
Exempting a player from one of the most basic fundamental parts of the game just doesn't sit well with me. It just simply doesn't. I don't know. You're gonna have a hard time winning this argument.
See, like to me, I would prefer the uniformed approach. I think it's extremely bizarre that within a single league there could be such a monumental difference between the two. It would be like in the AFC you go for an extra point. In the NFC, you have to go for two.
It would be, yes, that's the equivalent of it. It doesn't make any sense to me. Not our soccer fields are the same size, or the same dimensions.
Is that right?
Yes, field size can actually vary.
What? That's strange,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe there's. I'm sure somebody on the text line will hit back if I'm not getting that correctly. But from my understanding, not all soccer fields are uniformly the same size.
I like the way I view this in my mind is that if you're going to, and first of all, let me make it clear, I disagree with, I agree with you saying that there should be a uniformed approach. I disagree with the approach that you took. I would like to see pitchers removed from the offensive side of the game.
Why is that?
Because I think it would be like asking, a quarterback twice a game to go out and be a defensive back. Say, hey, I know this is not what you work on, it's what you do, but two plays a game, you got to go out there and be a DB.
The fact that Ben Roethlisberger can tackle is a part of Steeler history forever.
Mm.
Jerome Bettis fumbles on the goal line. The fact that your quarterback is athlete enough to stick an arm out there and has played some type of full range, for all position football as a kid or whatever the case may have been in Ben's football past, that creates an amazing Steeler story. And a part of football history, when a guy is asked to do a skill that's not part of his normal strong suit, but he can actually do it. What's the pitcher's name who got injured earlier this year who was pitching and hitting really well? I can't think of the kid's name. Somebody maybe.
Oh, you're saying for the Angels.
Yes.
Ohtani.
There you go.
Yeah.
So that's a beautiful story. That should be celebrated. The fact that they're not very good at it.
But with a DH, you would still give the option for Ohtani to hit. If he wanted to, I think. I guess. I don't know. I really don't know. I just think it's so strange. I think it's so strange that there's such a fundamental difference between two leagues within the same umbrella. Just bizarre.
I agree.
If you ask me. We got breaking news. Jameis Winston is likely to be, and we're hearing this from Ian Rappaport just a couple minutes ago, right before we went on the air, Bucks quarterback Jameis Winston has been suspended 3 games, I'm told. Now, Jameis, from what I understand, is accepting his suspension. He released a statement. Here is the quote. Quote, first and foremost, I would like to say I'm sorry to the Uber driver for the position I put you in. It is uncharacteristic of me, and I genuinely apologize. In the past 2.5 years, my life has been filled with experiences, opportunities, and events that have helped me grow, mature, and learn, including the fact that I have eliminated alcohol from my life. I know I have to hold myself to a higher standard on and off the field, and that I have a responsibility to my family, community, and teammates to live above the platform with which God has blessed me. I apologize to my teammates, the Buccaneers organization, and fans for letting them down for not being able to be out there for the first three games of the season. Although I am disappointed in the NFL's decision, I understand the NFL's process, and I embrace this as an opportunity to take advantage of the resources available to help me achieve the goals I have for myself. I now look forward to putting this behind me, and I will continue to work hard every day to be a positive influence in my community and be the best person, teammate, and leader I can be. End quote.
I think that's a great job on a statement by him, not pushing back, accepting responsibility, accepting it as a impetus to change. Clearly, he's stating here that he's already started that process of changing. Well, I think we can all agree that this behavior plus the stuff back in college at Florida State, all those kind of things paint a picture of Jameis Winston, which makes his suspension seem correct and right and just. But also, you know, we are a country that we want to see you change. We want to give you a second chance. In this case, maybe second or third chances here. But the statement does not do anything negative for his situation. I think it only makes him seem apologetic, sorry, and trying to do the right thing.
My one little, not beef, but just, I guess, being critical reading it, he's saying, you know, he's apologizing to the Uber driver for the position that he put her in, but also saying he's disappointed in the NFL's decision to suspend him. I would like to him for just to fully bow down. And don't talk about how disappointed it's. If you're apologizing to the Uber driver, then you're admitting on some level you did something inappropriate. So don't be resistant to the suspension. And I guess I'm kind of nitpicking there. But I would like, I don't think Jameis is in a position to be fighting back toward the league with disappointment. And I guess that's nitpicking, but still.
Yeah, fighting back, being disappointed and fighting back are two different things.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Chad, NFL.com ranked every coach in the NFL. Did Vance get a raw deal, or was he ranked just right? We'll get to it next. NFL.com ranked every coach in the National Football League. Did Vance get a raw deal, or was he ranked just right? Chad, where do you think that Vance was ranked by NFL.com?
These things are always so tough. I think at the top, it's pretty easy to distinguish who's a better coach than another. But once you get 20 and below, it's full of first-year guys, second-year guys, whether it's not a lot of prior experience to go off of. I'm going to say because the Broncos took steps back last year in so many facets, he's probably going to be late 20s, early 30s. Yeah, that makes sense.
Vance Joseph was ranked 30th out of 32 coaches. Here's the explanation from NFL.com. Quote, the Broncos took a step back in every phase last season, but especially on defense, Joseph's area of expertise. Some of that can be blamed on an anemic offense that kept the defense on the field for far too long. Though, Joseph wasn't able to get nearly as much out of his team as his predecessor. He and Steve Wilks are similar in that each coach defensive backs for years with only 1 year as a defensive coordinator before becoming a head coach. In theory, Joseph learned much from the pitfalls of his initial season, so he has an edge in understanding the demands of the job. How much understanding he'll receive from John Elway is another matter. End quote. Is 30th out of 32 fair, unfair, ranked high, too low, just right? Where you at?
Again, I think once you get past, you know, the mid-range on these kind of coach listings, I had a chance to look at some of the other guys on the list, and they're actually slotting all these first-year coaches by how good his team is. He hasn't coached that team. So Matt Patricia gets ranked ahead of Matt Nagy because Detroit has a better team than Chicago Bears. It's got nothing to do with your ability to actually coach the team.
So that was one of my biggest takeaways, what you just said right there, was the fact that Mike Vrabel at 29, Pat Shurmur at 27, Frank Reich at 26, and Matt Nagy at 25th, including Matt Patricia, who you just named at 24, are all first-time head coaches that are ranked ahead of Vance. And I know Pat Shurmur was interim a head coach a couple different times, I think in Philly and New York, but those are all first-time official head coaches that are ranked in front of Vance.
It's mind-boggling.
Is that mind-boggling? Is that unfair to Vance? Or because of how bad it was last year and how far the train came off the tracks, is that fair?
I think so. I think it is fair in that you were given a team, and essentially the same team that was there the year before, and now they took a step back in so many different directions, versus the first-year coaches who are going to get the benefit of the doubt because we don't have a track record, either good or bad, against them, versus your track record. Unfortunately, as a head coach, the team took a step back, and you went through a severe learning process, I'll call it.
It was a severe learning process, and he talked about it. You know, he's talked about it. You know, to Vance's credit, he hasn't been resistant to... You know, I'm on the verge of saying he hasn't been resistant to how bad he was. You know, he's acknowledged, while not saying it like I just said it, he's acknowledged on a couple different times, I need to coach my coaches better, and whatever decision needs to be made, I need to make it quicker. Which, both of those things ring so true to Broncos country, because there's these, you know, obtuse examples where the community's like, no, or yes, and Vance has, you know, just been a little bit slow on the trigger. Do you think those lessons can be applied from 1 year to the next, that he can take that big step forward that the Broncos expected him to start with at the outset?
I would certainly hope so, and I think John Elway knew, he had to know, with the... You know, experience of being a longtime DB coach, 1 year as a coordinator, now becoming a head coach. That's a steep hill. You're already climbing the hill, stepping from defensive backs coach to coordinator. And you don't have that job down after just 1 year. So you know what I'm saying? I've been coached by defensive coordinators who've been in that league, in that position for 20 plus years. They're far smoother, than the guy who's just done it 1 year. So then to take the next step and then become a head coach, you're climbing an even steeper hill the next year. So in some ways, you hadn't even got your footing at your previous job. Then you move into a even bigger job with a completely different list of demands and pressures. You're expected to know how to coordinate a defense, but now move on to be a head coach and now coordinate an offense and coach the coaches and deal with the media. I mean, it's such an amazingly different job than just being a coordinator. But you still need to have the same level of understanding of the X's and O's as the coordinators do. And you had, so I'm not trying to defend Vance. I'm just simply pointing out the fact that all these first year guys, you know, same thing for Vrabel, 1 year as a DC before moving on to become a head coach. Matt Patricia, who's of the first year coaches, I think is the highest on this list.
Right.
Is because he was a long time coordinator. He had, not that he had mastered that job, but he had, you know, think about the Patriots defense last year, very bad early in the season, gets that defense turned around. He has done jobs of turning groups around. He's had that experience. All these other first year guys hadn't, and now asked him to be a head coach. Again, that's just a very steep hill to climb.
It is, and, you know, one would call it drinking through a fire hose, Chad.
Yeah.
We've heard that
a number of times.
But I go back to what I said this time last year, before Vance ever coached a game. I'm not so sure that, and this isn't directly on Vance, and I hope I can articulate this the right way. When you put Vance in that position, as John Elway did after only, you know, one season of being a defensive coordinator, the year before that coaching defensive backs in Cincinnati, while Vance thought he was ready for the job, John thought he was ready for the job, I'm not so sure that John should have actually ever put him in that position. And I know everyone wants to be a head coach, but at the same time, when you look at it off merit, Vance Joseph did not have a head coaching resume that would qualify him to be the HC for the Denver Broncos, in my opinion. I don't think there was enough track record to hand the reins of a franchise that had just won a Super Bowl the 2 years before, while in that same season while the Broncos were winning a Super Bowl, Vance Joseph was coaching DBs. And I don't think that enough was on his resume to warrant that. Now, I know John believed in him, and I know Vance believed that he could do it, but that doesn't mean that he was ready to actually do it. You know, we could hire, you know, we have a couple guys that will, you know, work shifts on the board and things like that at night and run games. And I used to do those same things. So I feel comfortable talking about it. That's one thing. And it's hard to realize what that whole board is, all the knobs and levels and are you live and what are you taking from a satellite and do all that stuff. And you can get pretty good at that. And I can believe I'm ready to work a live show, but that doesn't mean you're ready to work a live show. You know, there needs to be more of a track record. So I'm actually not surprised. I said all of that, Chad, to say that I'm really not all that surprised taking a step back and looking at it the way that Vance struggled, because it wasn't as much, not none, but as much on the job learning some of those lessons that he learned last year before he ever got here in the first place.
I hear what you're saying. To go back to your first question, you know, was he ready for this opportunity? Is anybody truly ready? You know, Mike Tomlin went from 1 year as defensive coordinator to taking the Steelers in his first year to the playoffs. But he had a quarterback. You know, there was a team, there was a structure. Ownership could not have been more firmly in place with the Rooney family. How they do football in Pittsburgh, you know, all the... Dick LeBeau was defensive coordinator. You know what I mean? So he walked into a situation that's a little bit more ready for a guy of that lack of experience to kind of learn as he goes. And Mike Tomlin's been, I think we'd all agree, a very, very good head coach for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Will Vance Joseph become Mike Tomlin? I don't know. But from the question of did John Elway make the right move? If you look at a guy like Mike Tomlin, it certainly seems as if you can bring a guy in and he can have some success with that lack of experience, roughly the same age, a lot of similar background, coaching one position, DC becoming head coach. I guess, you know, the Gary Kubiak quote applies to almost everything. But it applies to Vance Joseph. And seriously, this year is going to be incredibly critical to what we're going to see. And we are fixing to find out.
Someone on the RamosLaw.com text line. And by the way, guys, if you want to get tagged in and become part of the show, 303-713-1043. That's simultaneously the phone number. So if you guys want to connect with us on a more personal level today, hit us up, 303-713-1043. Maybe we'll take a call or two. Chad, someone hit us up and said, where Elway messed up was not equipping Vance with more help. That's an interesting statement because it wasn't, and you referenced Dick LeBeau being the DC in Pittsburgh. It was two things working at once at the very same time, where Vance was stepping into a brand new role, never been a head coach before, and only been a DC for a year. Joe Woods, at the same time, is now your defensive coordinator, who had never done the job before. So you have two of your four phase coaches, offense coordinator, defense coordinator, head coach, special teams coordinator. Two of those four are – actually, excuse me, three of those four. Brock Oliva was never a special teams coordinator. So he's doing his job for the first time. Vance Joseph is doing his job for the first time. Joe Woods is doing his job for the first time with a quarterback who – his name is Trevor Siemian, and Paxton Lynch and Brock Osweiler. When you take a gigantic, monumental, let's take not just one but two steps back and you look at it, and you see an 8-game losing streak and a 5-11 season, I don't think I should be as shocked as I was in the moment when it was happening.
No. Hindsight's always going to be 20/20. But, yeah, looking at that situation – it's very difficult to be successful. I think about when they brought the Buffs back to to see you as head coach when Embry was head coach, Eric Bieniemy was offensive coordinator, and Greg Brown was defensive coordinator, kind of bringing the gang back together. All three of those guys, first time at their job. It's difficult to be successful in those situations. I mean, when I see Sean McVay go sit on a water cooler during a game and look at his play sheet because he's got 1,000% confidence that Wade Phillips knows exactly what he's doing when the defense is on the field, that gives Sean McVay clearly the best chance for success. Now, Sean McVay is a little different because he's still calling plays, so he needs that time to do that. But he could not be as comfortable in that role if it wasn't for the incredibly experienced guy who's calling the defense right now.
And believe it or not, I was about to go down the Wade Phillips conversation here in Denver, and I'm not even going to do it today, because that guy technically probably could have been here had the Broncos wanted that to be the case. So here's the bottom line. Do you believe that Vance Joseph can apply those hard lessons and not become just a competent coach, but where we sit this time in 2019, in June of 2019, and look back and say, holy moly, there's never been a greater jump from a first-year coach to a second-year coach than Vance Joseph.
I can't guarantee that. I there's no way I can guarantee
that. Well, I'm not asking you to guarantee it, but do you believe that will be the case?
I believe he will check off some of the bad football that he was responsible for from last year. Football's, you know, you've heard me say it, you've been on with me a number of times, such a funny game, and things can look one way and the reality can be different. So, did it have to be a playoff team for the fans to be happy? Can you be 9-7 and all arrows going in the right direction? Because in my mind, from an ownership standpoint, both those are acceptable outcomes.
9-7?
Yes. 8-8 is also an acceptable outcome if all the arrows are pointing in the right direction. 7-9. Now we're applying a different microscope to things. And how are you 7-9 and all arrows pointing in the right direction? That begins to be more difficult to reconcile those two. Then I've got to look a little bit harder and deeper and a little bit more critical eye.
Well, it will probably ultimately be almost like how we talked about Bradley Chubb and what defines success for him this year. And we can try to put numbers on it and, you know, what is it about pressures? Is it about sacks? Is it about playing time, starting, you know? But ultimately, you and I have kind of, and I hope I can say this, that we're kind of on the same page with, like, none of those hard and fast numbers are going to define success. You have to use your eyes and see what it looks like.
Right.
What does it look like? And I think the same logic applies to the Broncos as in, you know, what defines success in 2018 coming off a 5-win season. And because I don't know how to answer that. Like, to your original question, what if it's 9-7? What if it's 8-8 or 7-9? I think 7-9 will ultimately get Vance fired because they brought in a franchise quarterback. And it's his second year, and it begins the season on the hot seat. And if you end up with a losing record now, you can no longer say we've been to more Super Bowls than have had losing seasons. You have back-to-back losing seasons that for the first time since 1972. I just can't imagine John retaining Vance for a third year if 7-9 happens. So I do think in that case, a hard and fast number will probably determine his fate. But if it's 8-8, you know, what does that look like? Do you win the last three games of the year? You know, were you 5-8 going into week, you know, a 15 and you go 3-0 to end it? Does that momentum help?
Did you lose the last six in a row at 8-8? Well, then all arrows can't be pointing in the right direction if that's the case. So I think the original statement, at least for me, still stands. If the arrows are pointing in the right direction, you got off to a rocky start, case got nicked up, whatever the case may be, and you finished strong and you finished 8-8 and, you know, the defense was playing well, you were shutting people down. No fly zone has returned. Case Keenum was lighting it up and became a leader of the offense, and things were clicking. Yeah, why not?
Simple as that. Win more games.
You know what? You know what? I could go there with you because you're talking about, if that's the case, if it's a three-game turnaround in the NFL, that's a big deal. That's almost a 20% turnaround.
Yeah, and 8-8 teams do make playoffs.
Occasionally they do.
Yeah.
I don't think they will in this division. gut says no. But then you look at the way things were shaping up last year. It was like the Broncos had lost six games in a row, and we're looking around, and I'm like, you know, I know I sounded probably like an idiot because our eyes told us it was a bad football team.
There's still a chance.
But here on like Monday at 12:01, I'm like, I know you don't want to hear it, but they're still mathematically in it.
Playoffs.
I mean, so that's a tricky one. That's a tricky one. 8-8. That's a tricky one.
Again, 8-8 is the number, but so many factors on that. Did you lose last three in a row? Did you win your last six in a row? That 8-8 feels different. It plays differently publicly. It plays different nationally. The 49ers are a hot team because how they finished last year. So if you just looked at Kyle Shanahan's record, it's not very good. They won five in a row to end the season. Now everyone's, you know, predicting them to be this turnaround team this year.
They were an 0-9 football team at one point.
Yeah.
Kyle Shanahan, by the way, on this, and what got us started here, if you're just joining us, is that NFL.com ranked every coach in the National Football League. Vance Joseph was ranked 30th out of 32 coaches, including five different first-time head coaches that were all ranked ahead of Vance. Kyle Shanahan was 24th. Okay, so that little push at the end of the season has him up on this list, but my gut tells me this time next year, he ain't going to be ranked 24th. That's just what my gut tells me about Kyle Shanahan. Do you agree?
Yes, 23rd, actually.
Was he?
Patricia's 24th.
Oh, yep, good call.
Yeah, but if he takes the – now, each season is different unto itself, and you can't just expect to pick up where you left off. But how they finish with five in a row, with the quarterback, with the optimism, it's hard to imagine he will be in the 20s for long.
Another noteworthy coach from around here is that Adam Gase was listed at 21. I'm looking at last year's list. Okay, I got the top 10 here. Did you already look at the top 10? Have you already laid eyes on it?
Yes, I have.
Okay, I wanted to quiz you again. Let's just let our listeners know how this went from 10 on down. Mike Zimmer was number 10, coach of the Vikings. Number 9. Was John Gruden. Let me stop there. What did you make of John Gruden being on this list?
I got two feelings about it. John Gruden is a football guy. You know, when Brian Billick left coaching, he became a media guy. He's still a former head coach, but he doesn't grind at football the way that John Gruden does. John Gruden gets up and went to his office and watched tape all day and sat with coaches. He did football all the time. He wasn't going on cruises. He wasn't didn't have a collection of bonsai trees in his den. He kept the same, almost the same hours he did as a media guy, still working on football, as he did as a head coach. So he's a little bit different than someone else being out as long as he was and stepping in, because he's been so actively involved in the game and grinding at the game. So part of me says, yeah, of course he deserves to be in the top 10. And another part of me is like, I don't know. You've been out that long. Can you instantly reconnect? Because as we talked about before, football is not all about the X's and O's. As a coach, it's about your ability to relate to the players. And you've been gone from so long from that role. Can you instantly step into that role and get people to buy in what you're saying?
All really good points. And I appreciate the fact that he kept his football tools sharp. Why, as a media person, I'm also looking at a sample size of his last 6 years in Tampa. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is the better part of a decade. And he was a losing coach at that point. So what I'm seeing here is that the fact that he has a Super Bowl to his name
the Raiders
is carrying a lot of weight. I mean, his last six seasons in Tampa, he's 7-9, 5-11, 11-5, but lost their first playoff game. Then 4-12, then 9-7. They squeaked in the playoffs and lost, and then 9-7. So I'm skeptical of that rating. I think it's a little bit too high. Followed by Doug Peterson at 8, Andy Reid at 7, Mike McCarthy at 6, John Harbaugh at 5, Mike Tomlin at 4, Pete Carroll at 3, Sean Payton at 2, Bill Belichick at 1. Any beefs there?
No beef. I mean, you could quibble on it, but no beef with it, not really.
I do think it's interesting that there are probably two coaches in the top five that, if they don't have legit seasons, could be out as coach, and that's John Harbaugh and Mike Tomlin.
Mike Tomlin, no way. Harbaugh, possibly. Steelers don't change coaches. That's not what they do.
Keep an eye on it. Keep an eye on it. Chad, did John Elway make a mistake with two Bronco rookies that look like some of his best picks? We'll explain next.